If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast looks at movies between 1895 and 1990. We cover all mainstream and genre films, books, TV, and whatever else Terry gets obsessed about. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The new voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can leave messages on Skype at Paleo Cinema. All lowercase and no dash. This podcast may include swearing and adult content. So if you hear anything you don't understand, just fucking Google it.
Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 76. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around in the Paleo Cinema A to Z project, we're looking at movies that start with a B. This is my little conceit to make sure that I have a rough idea of which movies I'm going to talk about in the podcast. So from now until basically another 24 podcasts after this, I'm going to be looking at movies alphabetically. Now, they can be any genre, doesn't matter what it is, doesn't matter where it came from, doesn't matter anything else. But yeah, basically, that's what I'm doing for the next bit. I hope everybody's doing fine. We're doing pretty okay here, except for one unfortunate fact. It's heading towards winter. Now, winter's a relative term, and I'll explain that in a little more detail. For some people, winter is snow up to your dick and wind chill factors that basically make the place look like the day after tomorrow. For other people, it's different. I was talking to my friend Ivor Cole up at ABC Radio Darwin last night. No, actually, night before last, when we were doing, I did a talk with him about Rio Bravo for ABC Radio. And it got chilly in Darwin. Now, Darwin's tropical. It's not too far. It's, it's about 400 kilometres from the equator, maybe less. And, it got cold there overnight. It got down to 18 degrees centigrade, which in old school talk, he said, pausing for a moment while he looks it up on the internet. Okay, I've got it. It got down to 64 degrees Fahrenheit in Darwin overnight. And Ivor was getting calls from listeners saying that they had their jumpers on and wearing thick woolen boots and things like that because it got down to 64 degrees Fahrenheit or 18 degrees for the rest of the planet apart from the USA. So, that cold is relative. We'll be honest about that. It's what you're acclimatized to. Now, down here, it's been getting down to 0 degrees centigrade, about 32 Fahrenheit overnight. It's been cold and wet, and there's been a bit of a cold wind and things like that. And I don't like it. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I like the warm weather a lot better. So, at the moment, we're suffering through what we consider to be cold weather. So, that, of course, gives opportunity to see a lot of movies. And I'm just going to bring up my Mizo in a second, tell you what I've been watching. And I have been watching some interesting films this time. I've really kind of gone out of my comfort zone a little bit and looked at some of the movies that I thought I should see, but really hadn't gotten around to, which is always a little bit of fun there. Okay, I'm going to just rack that up now. Dun-dun-dun. Yeah, I did see the Billy Wilder film from 1964, Kiss Me Stupid, with Dean Martin, Kim Novak and Ray Walston. And it's a bit of a fun sex comedy, and it does have a very European sensibility. It copped a lot of shit at the time from the censors and the people who seem to believe that they know what people should watch better than the people themselves, because there's a little bit of a kind of subversive message there, which I appreciated. It's very kind of European in its sensibilities, and a lot of fun because of that. I really enjoyed that side of it. I mean, there are some obvious jokes and a little bit, the humour's a little bit broad for my taste at times, but yeah, it was a bit of fun, and Dean Martin was pretty much playing an alternate version of his Dean Martin ring-a-ding-ding kind of persona, and it worked quite well. And Martin, of course, was always an underestimated actor. When I was talking about Rio Bravo with Ivor, one of the things that came up is just how much that film is the story of Dean Martin's character Dude. But Dean Martin in Kiss Me Stupid, it's worth seeing. It's black and white, it's a bit of fun, and not too bad at all. I did also see John Borman's first feature film, Catch Us If You Can, which was an interesting one. It was an attempt to do, for the Dave Clark Five, another kind of Britpop band of the 60s, what Help and had done for the Beatles. That was the intention of the people who financed the film. But John Borman took it in a different direction and kind of made it about the cult of celebrity and the ridiculousness of PR and spin and all that sort of thing. And it's not entirely successful. I think the Dave Clark Five were much better musicians than they were actors. But it's got the usual kind of coterie of British character actors around the edges, keeping things moving along and being a bit interesting. But it's really worth taking a look at. I found it very cheaply because Borders bookshops in Australia are basically dying and they're selling off a lot of stuff. And Sal and I went down to a Borders store and I picked it up very, very cheaply on DVD. So their loss is of course, my gain. But if you get a chance to see that one, it's worth looking at. It seems to be something else at first. It seems to be one of those light, frothy Britpop movies of the 1960s, a bit like Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter did for Herman's Hermits and things like that. But really well worth checking out because it's got some good location shooting. It's got some lovely set pieces that John Borman does. And he went, of course, straight from this to doing Point Blank. So I can see why they would have let him do it. He was an up-and-coming director. He was very dynamic in what he did, and he had an alternative slant on things at the time, and that, of course, makes it a little out of the ordinary. And another thing I saw, which I really enjoyed, and I've got to thank Brian from Over the Hammockers podcast for mentioning this one to me, Murphy's War, starring Peter O'Toole. Great film. It's got Philippe Noiret, one of my favourite French actors, in it as well. Basically, a sailor called Murphy has been sunk by a German submarine. His boat's been sunk, and he ends up being the only survivor of that disaster. And he's set, this is in Venezuela, off the coast of Venezuela. And basically, Murphy decides he's going to destroy the German submarine. And it's beautiful. It's got an unusual location on the Orinoco River. It's got some great action scenes, and particularly with the aeroplane that gets salvaged from the sunken ship. And it's a good, honest little thriller, and well worth seeing. It's a little bit forgotten these days, but O'Toole's great in it. It also stars his wife at the time, Sian Phillips, as a nurse who nurses him back to health. So, really interesting film, directed by Peter Yates. Of course, we know him from Bullet and other things. But I kind of like the film. It's well worth sitting back. It's one of those ones where you can sit back, have a beer and some munchies, and just go for it. Really a lot of fun there. I also saw John Landis's Burke and Hare, starring Simon Pegg and Nick Serkis. And yeah, it's very hit and miss. I could see what they were trying to do, and I appreciate what they were trying to do. And some of the gross-out jokes work really well, but there's a lot of humour in this film. And the ensemble cast is fantastic. It's got Tom Wilkinson in it. It's got, of course, Simon Pegg and Andy Serkis in it. It's just full of great character actors. But the punchlines for the humour somehow fade out. They're a bit of a fizzer. There's a beautiful setup. There's a lot of sparking going on in the fuse that's being lit. But the explosion you expect from the humour just kind of turns out to be a little bit of a fizz. So, I'm not sure. It's a bit hard to diagnose exactly what's gone wrong there with it. But of course, this was going to be Landis's big comeback, and I think it was produced by Ealing Films, the resurrected Ealing Films. But it doesn't quite hit the mark, and that's a shame because I know Landis in the past has had that ability to kind of hit people over the head with jokes and punchlines and action sequences that really in such a way that it really does bring the movie to life. I mean, the set design's great, the locations are great, costuming, everything's perfect, but it just does have that little bit of lack of follow-through, in a sense, which is a shame because I came into that film with a lot of goodwill and really was hoping that it would be what, you know, it would have followed through and done what it was intending to do. As I said, I saw Rio Bravo as well. I won't talk about that because I'm going to save that one for the R's when I get to the R part of the alphabet. It's on my list to do that. I did see a classic film from the 1930s. This one I had had on DVD for a long time and really wanted to take a look at it, and because of course it starts with B, I really wanted to see if I wanted to do it for this particular podcast. It turns out I didn't, but the film is Jean Renoir's 1932 Baudou Save from Drowning, which is a kind of anarchic comedy with a bookseller, Mr. Listingua, rescues a tramp from a suicidal plunge into the river, brings him into his household, and basically this tramp, Baudou, played by Michel Simon, wreaks havoc in the household. He spits in books, he pinches the parlour maid in the arse, he seduces a housemaid and the wife of the family, and basically wreaks havoc on them. Ultimately, though, everybody's happier. Now, you might remember this film was remade as Down and Out in Beverly Hills, directed by Paul Mazursky, starring Richard Dreyfuss and Nick Nolte, but the original is beautiful. It's a soft, not gentle, but really kind of fun film, and it's great to see Paris as it was in the 1930s. There's a lot of location shooting in this film, and I really like it a lot. It's just one of those films which doesn't have any belly laughs in it, but it's got a lovely anarchic humour. It's lovely. It's just a beautiful film, and it shows the kind of thing that shouldn't be remade. I don't think that Down and Out in Beverly Hills had anywhere near the charm and grace of this film, but if you get a chance to see it, and it shouldn't be too difficult to locate a copy of it, definitely worthwhile. It's a lovely thing. I did see a good documentary too, a really good one called In the Shadow of Hollywood Race Movies. And what's the title of it? In the Shadow of Hollywood, Race Movies and the Birth of Black Cinema. It was about the history of black cinema in America. People like Oscar Michaud and Herb Jeffries and Lena Horne and all those people that kind of contributed to the birth of black cinema. And it's a good, solid documentary. I managed to kind of locate a couple of Oscar Michaud's films from the silent era and the early sound era, and I'm going to watch them at some stage. Really an important one, and it kind of fleshes out an aspect of cinema history that I was kind of vaguely familiar with, but really hadn't focused on very much. And I do think I want to find out more about that and really kind of get into it a little bit. Now, I went from there. See, I'd done Baudou Save from Drowning, and I'd done a good documentary about race movies, to the very first movie I ever saw with an R rating. Now, the R rating came in 1972 in Australia, and it was a reaction to the more adult content in films, and people under 18 weren't allowed in there. I was, let's see, 1972. I was, he said, working this out, 15 at the time, and I snuck into, well, I basically put on a deep voice and smothered myself in Brut cologne, and bought a ticket and went in to see two films. The first one was Slaughter, starring Jim Brown, directed by Jack Starrett, blaxploitation film. Second one I saw was Boxcar Bertha, directed by Martin Scorsese. Now, the thing I didn't know when I went in to see these two films is the guy at the box office didn't give a shit whether I was 5 years old or 50 years old. He just sold me the ticket. So that was good. But Slaughter was the first one I saw. And it's an interesting blaxploitation film. Jim Brown's in it. It's got Stella Stevens. It's got Rip Torn playing the villain. And he's a craven fucker in this film. Don Gordon as a sidekick to the Jim Brown character. He's a bit of fun in there as well. And the interesting thing about this film I found, there's a few interesting things, is Rip Torn would have been really, really great playing a brother to Bradford Dillman in a movie. If they have ever got together in the 1960s, 1970s and played a pair of arsehole brothers who were total cocks and dickheads and arseholes, that would have been a film worth seeing, because they have a very similar kind of persona, but they bring their own stuff to it. And Rip Torn in this one's a racist, ugly bastard working for the mafia. And it doesn't end well for him, of course. And Jim Brown's great to see in this. Jim Brown, of course, being an ex-football player, there's scenes of him. The whole thing is filmed in Mexico. There are scenes of him running away from cars, trying to run him down. And that guy could run. He was like a brick wall moving. He just kind of, you know, unstoppable. And the action sequences work really well. But there is a really weak conceit in the action sequences there. They have some point-of-view shots in the action sequences. And not even point-of-view shots, but just shots in the action sequences where they suddenly use a fisheye lens in one moment of the action sequence, which kind of cuts you out of it. It's an experiment I think Jack Starrett did. But the use of the fisheye lens is really unusual in this film. So, yeah, but I still liked it. It does have Stella Stevens in a couple of nude scenes, which I appreciated very much at the time and still have a certain aesthetic fondness for. And, yeah, it's not the best blaxploitation movie ever made, but it's well kind of mid-range blaxploitation. It's worth seeing. And Jim Brown in this is pretty damn good. Wearing a tux, shooting racists, and trying to... basically crashing a car into a light plane to stop it from flying away. So, you know, all good fun there. And the other thing I've seen that really kind of has had an influence on me, ABC One, the main ABC national broadcaster channel here in Australia, showed Machete Maidens Unleashed on television. Now, that documentary's been doing the film festival circuit for a little while now. And it's basically about the history of American exploitation films that were made in the Philippines in the 60s and 70s. And it's a lot of fun. It's made by the same guys who did Not Quite Hollywood. So it's got that same kind of thing where they interview a lot of the actors and actresses involved, the directors involved. And it's a very quick-paced documentary, but a lot of fun. I've actually found a lot of the movies that they talk about in this, the Blood Island trilogy, and a whole bunch of others, and really, really enjoyed it. It's if you get a chance to see it, and I know particularly that Rupert Pupkin really wants to see this film, and it's worth your time. It's coming out on DVD in Australia. It should be out right now. In fact, I may go up a bit later today and pick up a copy of it, but great film, and it does have that kind of passion for exploitation that was shown in Not Quite Hollywood, and the documenting of the history of this kind of film, the same way they did with Ozploitation in Not Quite Hollywood, is a really interesting thing. There were dangerous stunts done, and any time they wanted to have soldiers for an action scene, they'd call up Ferdinand Marcos and get him to send the army in for them. There's some talk about some of the set designs from Apocalypse Now, which may shock you a little bit, but it's really, really fun. I think the kind of films that we're talking about here aren't as broadly ranged as the Ozploitation ones were, so it's a little more focused on a particular kind of action film, women in prison films and things like that, and war movies in particular, a bit of kung fu action. Wing Wing and For Your Hide Only get a bit of a mention there, because one of the producers was Andrew Leopold, who is the Australian expert on Filipino cinema. In fact, he sent me a Facebook message recently saying, send me a personal message if you want to find out more about this kind of stuff. So I'm going to do that after the podcast and just see what Andrew can steer my way as far as Filipino cult cinema is concerned. And if you're a movie fan at all, this one's definitely one to see. It's just vital and interesting. I do hope it gets a DVD and probably a Blu-ray release in the States really quality doco, and it's a kind of style of documentary that is becoming uniquely Australian. It's really, I can't talk too much about this one because one of the movies I'm talking about today, Brides of Blood, is from this particular documentary. It's a B film. It started with a B, and I really, really like it. It's if you go to machetemaidensunleashed.com, you can find out a lot more about this one. Lots and lots of blood, guts, and interesting stuff. Of course, it was directed and written and co-edited by Mark Hartley, who'd done Not Quite Hollywood, but lots of great stuff here, and I really do recommend it for you. Anyway, I'm going to take a bit of a break. I may actually go down and buy a copy of Machete Maidens Unleashed in this break. And when I get back, I'm going to talk about Brides of Blood, the Filipino / American action film that I saw as a part of Machete Maidens Unleashed. Back in a moment, and grab a drink and we'll have a chat.
Tout seul au fond de la Seine, je commence à m'ennuyer. En vain, je me démène pour pouvoir me libérer. 10 ans dans la même pose, je vous assure que c'est long. Depuis que je me décompose, je fais peur aux poissons qui fichent le camp sans rémission. Je suis un noyé assassiné par un gars qu'on voulait à mon porte-monnaie. Je n'avais pas un centime, lui pour cacher son crime, il me jeta dans l'abîme, et depuis je m'abîme dans cette masse d'eau. Je suis un noyé assassiné, j'ai au cou un boulet m'empêchant de remonter. Parler d'une aventure, voilà 10 ans que ça dure, avec ça je vous jure. Encore, si on m'avait flanqué dans un tonneau, au lieu d'eau il y avait eu du vin clairet. Mais non, mes chairs deviennent molles, je me désole et je m'étiole, la scène ne charrie pas l'alcool. Plaignez, plaignez, tous les noyés assassinés, plaignez.
That was Felipe Clay singing a song called L'Assassin Annué, The Bored Assassin, from the second movie I'm going to talk about today, which I haven't actually told you what it is yet. It's Bell, Book and Candle from 1958, starring James Stewart and Kim Novak. So just thought I'd throw that in there because it's a bit of an unusual track to be in a mainstream Hollywood film by Columbia Pictures in 1958. So let's talk about some Filipino exploitation cinema. I'm going to read you the blurb from Machete Maidens Unleashed just to get you in the mood for this. There's a really nice blurb in the press release for that documentary, which kind of says it all about this kind of stuff. Let's have a look here. Karate kicking midgets, paper mache monsters, busty babes with blades. Filipino genre films of the 70s and 80s have it all. This one's actually the 60s, but we'll let that go. Boasting cheap labor, exotic scenery, and non-existent health and safety regulations, the Philippines was a dreamland for exploitation filmmakers whose renegade productions were soon engulfing drive-in screens around the globe, like a tidal schlock wave. There we go. So that's basically it. American companies and American artists went over to the Philippines to make cheap exploitation movies because they wanted soldiers, they could get the Filipino army under Ferdinand Marcos to give them a hand. If they wanted helicopters or trucks or machine guns or explosions, it was all available to them because the Philippines wanted their business. Now, this particular one's on the kind of front end of that, the Brides of Blood. Now, I'm kind of learning about this as we go, so I'm not as expert on this as I am on some of the other genres that we deal with in paleo cinema. But I'm going to give you what I've got. I did see two movies by the same people before I saw this one. Now, the first one I saw, I'll give you background. Basically, Sal and I went to London in 2004 at a Virgin megastore, not too far from Tottenham Court Road. I found a couple of Filipino vampire movies, as you do. They were released in the UK. They haven't been released in Australia or anywhere else that I know of, apart, of course, from the Philippines. And they were The Blood Drinkers from 1964, which is directed by Gerardo de Leon, just like Brides of Blood was, and Blood of the Vampires, directed by the same guy. One of the interesting things about looking at Filipino cinema of the time is that a lot of the people who made these films, people like Gerardo de Leon and Eddie Romero and Eddie Garcia and people like that, really are well-respected. Eddie Romero, the co-director of Brides of Blood, was named the National Artist of the Philippines in 2003. He didn't just do exploitation films. He did all different kinds of films. And Romero's films, according to the National Artist Citation, states, are delivered with an utterly simple style, minimalist but never empty, always calculated, precise and functional but never predictable. And to be honest with you, I'll go along with that with Brides of Blood. The thing is, he's really got a reputation for excellence. He's written a lot of films as well, as far back as 1947. And he wrote his last film in 1987. I'm just looking it up on the Wiki Filipinas website, which is the Wikipedia for the Philippines. And, you know, you'd find things where you can find them. And as far as the director's concerned, he directed his first one, Kamay Ng Dios Ang, not sure what that means, in 1947 again. And his most recent film was directed in 2006. So the guy's had a long, long career as a director, very well respected. And his co-director in this film was Gerardo de Leon, who died in 1981. He was born in 1913. He had a nickname of Manong Jerry, and he was known as the father of Philippine cinema because of his contributions to the industry. And interesting director. The films made in the Philippines, you've got to remember, this is after World War II. This is 20 years after World War II, pretty much, the stuff we're talking about. America pretty much took over the Philippines, and of course then Marcos took over, but at this time there was still a lot of American influence there. This shows in Brides of Blood. I'll just go through a little bit of the cast list. The main cast, for the most part, are Americans. Kent Taylor, interesting character, Kent Taylor, and I'll tell you how he relates to the planet Krypton. Kent Taylor was a kind of B-movie actor. He's kind of like a low-rent Clark Gable or Errol Flynn. He's tall, good-looking kind of guy, pencil-thin mustache. He played Boston Blackie, and he had a pencil mustache in there, hence the song Pencil-Thin Mustache by Jimmy Buffett. And the interesting thing about him is he was one of the people that they named Clark Kent after. And I'll tell you why. The Clark came from Clark Gable, when Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster created Superman. Because, you know, Clark Gable was the biggest movie star in the world at the time. And Kent Taylor, who was Jerry Siegel's wife's brother-in-law, the actor Kent Taylor. So Siegel and Shuster put together Clark Gable and Kent Taylor and came up with Clark Kent, which is kind of a bit of a head spin there. It's quite wild. Now, at the time he made this film in 1968, he was 61 years old. His career was not over, but on the kind of diminishing end of it. And he's got that kind of slick back hair and the pencil mustache, which is kind of anachronistic for 1968. Doesn't matter where you are. And you know, not a bad looking guy. He's quite a presence in this film. He doesn't have too many facial expressions to play with, really, but he's in there. He plays a guy called Dr. Paul Henderson. I probably should do a synopsis before I get into the characters. Here we go. Natives of a tropical island have to contend with man-eating plants and animals, mutations caused by radioactivity. Virgin sacrifice becomes the norm. A small group of interlopers become caught up in the mayhem. And the interlopers basically are Kent Taylor playing Dr. Paul Henderson. He's a scientist investigating radiation mutations. John Ashley, who had a long career in Philippine cinema, he did the other films in what's become known as the Blood Island trilogy, of which this is the first one. Brides of Blood's the first in the trilogy. Odd thing about the Blood Island trilogy, there are four films in it. I'll go into that a little bit later. But yeah, he was in things like The Twilight People, and he started out doing those kind of AIP teenage movies in the early 1960s. Let's see what we've got for him on the IMDb. He was in things like How to Stuff a Wild Bikini, for instance, a Beach Blanket Bingo, and The Eye Creatures, he was in that as well. Muscle Beach Party, he was in that as well. So basically, he started out with one of those guys with the kind of early Tony Curtis haircuts, standing in the background next to a surfboard in those kind of movies and having a few lines in the thing. He went over to the Philippines and became a producer, amongst other things, as well as an actor. Not a great actor, admittedly, but kind of interesting. He spent a number of years over there because he's in Filipino films from about 1968 till at least 1973 when he did Beyond Atlantis. And 1973 is also the year he did Twilight People, which is kind of like a version of The Island of Dr. Moreau. I remember seeing that on Australian television in the late 70s. He was also one of the producers of the A-Team TV series, oddly enough. And if you hear that voiceover where they're telling you about how the A-Team have gone underground, and if you can find them, you can hire the A-Team kind of thing, blurb at the start, that's actually John Ashley's voice doing that voiceover for the beginning of the first four seasons of the A-Team. The other American actor in the film is Beverly Powers, who started her career in the 1950s as not Beverly Powers, but oddly enough, Beverly Hills, or Miss Beverly Hills in some cases. She was in a whole bunch of studio films at the time. Let's see what she was in early on. She was a nightclub stripper in Breakfast at Tiffany's, for instance. She was in the Comedy of Terrors, the film with Peter Lorre and Boris Karloff and those guys in 1963. Yep, Peter Lorre, Vincent Price, Boris Karloff. Let's have a look here. What else? She was in a few episodes of The Fugitive. She was in Kisses for My President, the weird comedy with Fred McMurray and Polly Bergen about the first female president of the United States. She played a stripper called Nana Peel. So that shows you the kind of stuff she did. She was in I'll Take Sweden with Bob Hope. Basically, she played a lot of strippers in her career. And in Brides of Blood, she plays Paul Henderson's wife, Carla, who at the start of the film kind of makes out with one of the cabin boys on the boat taking them to the island. So she puts it about a bit. The other thing you might remember her from, if you've seen the Byron Haskin film, The Power, with George Hamilton, and there's a scene with Nehemiah Persoff, where he's killed by remote control by the evil Superman, played by Michael Rennie. And he's in a party. They're hiding out at a party at a convention of businessmen. And there's a girl sitting on him and kissing him and things like that, and she kind of realizes that he's dead. That's Beverly Powers. So, yeah, she's kind of thing. She's also More Dead Than Alive, playing a kind of dance hall girl. I mentioned More Dead Than Alive last podcast, the one with Clint Walker and Vincent Price in it. So, yeah, she's been in a few things. Mostly, I mean, that's got to be a weird movie career. What have they done? I've played 15 different strippers. And she was playing strippers right up until 1979 on an episode of Fantasy Island. So, basically, for 20 years, from Breakfast at Tiffany's, pretty much 61. Yeah, for nearly 20 years, she played strippers. And in this one, she's kind of buxom blonde. She's got a beehive hairdo. She dresses inappropriately for walking through jungles. And she's there basically to snog cabin boys, have some really weird, terse dialogue with her husband about how alienated they are, and to almost get killed by carnivorous trees. And I'll play a little bit of the audio from Brides of Blood. I'm not sure whether I'm describing it very well, but it's kind of weird. It's from 1968. And I'll then come back and tell you why I liked this film when I saw it. I was willing to give it a go. I'd just seen the documentary. And I really kind of wanted to see what these films brought to cinema.
Beyond belief, a hideous journey into the dark world where nightmares are born. Now, visit one of the most mysterious corners of the world, where unbelievably cruel, barbaric customs are still practiced.
Aren't you growing up a little fast, little boy?
You tell me.
Carla, the sensual one. No mortal man could satisfy her inner cravings. She searched for her unnatural pleasures by night, when it was on the prowl.
He does not devour his victims. He merely satisfies himself on them.
can't they get torn to pieces?
Okay, so these Westerners come to this island where the natives are really unusual for a couple of reasons, one of which is they're all wearing modern print cloth clothing. The girls are wearing sarongs with matching bras, and I'm not sure how they make bras on a kind of deserted island off the coast of the Philippines, but they do. And all the guys have really neat haircuts. So it's a little bit, except for one person, a character called Goro, who is played by an actor who turns up in a hell of a lot of these kind of exploitation films in the Philippines, a guy called Bruno Punzalan. He turns up in any number of them. He's a kind of bald-headed guy with big, juggy ears. And he plays Goro, who is the kind of manservant to the nobleman living on the island, Esteban Powers, played by Mario Montenegro, who lives in a big house on the island where all of his servants are small people, like basically dwarves and midgets. There are four of them who are basically his manservants and who wear sarongs and serve dinner. They have about three scenes where people get them served dinner. And these four little people basically are the servants in this guy's house. So, you know, people could get creeped out anyway, just by the fact that this guy's living on an island. Everybody else is living under extremely primitive circumstances except him. And he's got the Lollipop Guild running the house. So, a little bit odd there. But yeah, that's part of the charm of the film. And there's a great big ugly statue in the middle of the village where the sacrifices are done. Now, this is the thing I don't understand about this film. You've got a monster on the island that comes out at night, devours, well, doesn't devour, but basically rapes and mutilates virgins. The village sets up a thing where they've got great big X's made out of bamboo poles. They strap girls to them to sacrifice to this monster. Now, it's been happening for about 10, 20 years. How does that start? How do you set up going, okay, well, we're being attacked by this village, this kind of enormous rapist thing that looks like a cross between an extra from HR Puff and Stuff and a bowl of rancid oatmeal. And how, you know, what are we going to do? Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to randomly select girls from the village because we've got a ton of them in this particular village. And then we're going to strap them up so that the monster leaves us alone. That's what happens in the village. And there are some scenes of topless Filipino ladies basically bumping against this paper mache and rubber monster. And then small blood-soaked parcels are buried in the ocean afterwards kind of thing. It's a weird setup, but you kind of got to buy into the schlock value of this film to appreciate it. The production values are quite good. The photography is great. The action scenes are well set out, and they create a lovely little kind of capsule world in this film where everything's normal during the daytime, but at nighttime, all the trees develop tentacles that reach out and grab people and rip them apart, and insects can turn from monsters to cockroaches during the daytime, so overnight, they change. This mutation's kind of like a werewolfy thing, where anything that's mutated by the radiation that's come through from the nuclear test blasts at Bikini Atoll, because this island apparently is not too far away from there, and the villagers were moved onto the island after those tests, so they're not affected by this. The weird thing is that at night time, the whole island becomes something else. It becomes dangerous and kind of eerie. There's a scene with, which is ludicrous, but yeah, you got to buy into this stuff, where Dr. Paul, played by Kent Taylor, is attacked by a moth. The moth gets bigger and then attacks him and cuts his hand open. The moth has mutated overnight, and you know, even the insects buzzing around your lamps are dangerous on this island at night time. It's a really weird setup. And basically, I do like it. I like it a lot. It's one of those things which is totally absurd. The monster does not look real at all. The acting and the dialogue, because I think some of the actors are pronouncing their English phonetically, or if not, their English language skills are quite limited. but there's very stilted dialogue. There's some very bad acting in it. But the locations really kind of make this work. They make it an interesting thing. It's somewhere different. And the scale on which the thing is filmed, there are a lot of villages, and the statue in the middle of the village is quite large. I mean, the production values are quite good for the low budget, because obviously it was fairly cheap to do all these things in the Philippines at the time. And I kind of thought, I was impressed with what they achieved, even though a lot of it looked cheesy. You realize the circumstances under which they're working, and you go, yeah, they actually tried to make this good. They had things like waving tentacles, which you knew you were being manipulated by guys sitting up the trees with strings and guys sitting behind bushes prodding things and stuff like that. Doesn't matter. If you drink the Kool-Aid on this one, you can see that they create a kind of groovy island where the trees can devour you at night, and a monster is rampaging through it, and the people are scared. And every village has got a couple of machetes hanging on the wall in each room, and all the guys in the village have very neat haircuts and very well tailored sarong kind of lap things to wear. I don't know whether I'm explaining this movie very well, but it's a lot of fun. It's if you can buy into the 1960s, 1970s drive-in aesthetic, you know, you can really kind of get a lot out of this film. Now, I have dipped briefly into a couple of the other Blood Island ones. I haven't had time to watch them all yet, but they're a bit of fun. And I think because I've been spending a little bit of my time watching more quality films lately, I did Boat Who Saved from Drowning, Jean Renoir, and I spent a lot of time researching Rio Bravo for the ABC radio gig. A movie like this is a kind of, It's like you've been out to a whole bunch of really good restaurants and you're just hanging out for KFC or a hamburger of some kind. And this is kind of a hamburger movie. I think that it's about time for these films to be re-evaluated and re-appreciated too. They're available around the place. There are torrents available and you can purchase a number of them online if you choose to. But if you want to kind of get away from, now, I don't mean any disrespect to you, Brian, but Hammer and Amicus and the kind of mainstream horror films that a lot of people are watching at the moment, you could do worse than do these kind of films. They're the kind of Asian locations and the Asian crew and the kind of free and easy attitude they have while making these films really does add to the experience. So check it out, Brides of Blood. There's a lot of clips from it on YouTube, so you can kind of get a feel as to whether it's something you will like. But it was nice to get back to my roots as a not a drive-in viewer and a cheap cinema viewer in the 1970s, hanging around places like the Capitol and the State Theatre in Sydney to watch any kind of weird and wonderful exploitation film that came up. It really kind of took me back to that start of my appreciation of movies. So I'm going to take another break now and get back, and we'll have a look at a very mainstream movie from 1958, Bell, Book and Candle, directed by Richard Quine and starring James Stewart, Kim Novak, Jack Lemmon, Ernie Kovacs, Hermione Gingold, Janice Rule, and a host of others, and Elsa Lanchester as well. That was George Dunning's theme from Bell, Book and Candle. I do like the music from this film. It's kind of a little bit different for a studio film in the 1950s. Now, tell you a couple of things about this film. First thing I'm going to tell you is something I like about this film. Next things are things I don't like about the film. Now, first thing I like about the film is you got James Stewart and Kim Novak making a romantic comedy in the same year that Vertigo was released. Now, of course, they starred in Vertigo together. It was about a really fucked up relationship between a copper called Scotty and a woman who looked exactly like what Scotty presumed was a dead woman. So very deep and serious and psychologically twisted Hitchcock film. Really fucked up protagonists. And then, same year, a romantic comedy about a New York publisher who falls in love with a witch. This is kind of the equivalent of the same year as Silence of the Lambs, Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins doing a rom-com. It's at that same level of dissonance. This is to say it's not a fun movie, because it very much is. So that's one of the things I like about it, the fact that the same year they made one of the deep and sexually twisted, most twisted of Hitchcock's films, they did this. Wasn't liked by a lot of the critics, but I kind of like the fact that they did it. Things I don't like about the movie. I think Jimmy Stewart's miscast in this film. And I think he mugs a lot. He does a lot of stupid facial expressions in this movie, which I kind of don't take to particularly. And I think that kind of makes the movie suffer a little bit. The movie is based on a play that was first done in Broadway in 1950 by a guy called John Van Druten. The play itself ran nearly a year, and it starred Rex Harrison and Lily Palmer in the roles played by James Stewart and Kim Novak. It was pretty popular, and it's a bit of fun. But in this film, there is a good rapport between James Stewart and Kim Novak. Don't get me wrong, but I think he's wrong for the role. Not because of his age. He turned 50 while the film was being made. But that kind of, you know, she could be playing 25, 30, who knows. But the age difference doesn't really matter from our modern perspective, speaking as a guy whose wife is 17 years younger than him. But I don't think he's right for the role. I think you need somebody with a little more of sophistication than the persona that James Stewart brings to the role. But, yeah, there are movies where people are miscast that kind of work. I think that Humphrey Bogart was miscast in The Barefoot Contessa, but I like him in it. You know, that kind of thing. It doesn't necessarily make for an entirely bad experience for the audience. The other thing I don't like about the movie is the ending. I'm going to tell you why at the ending of this. But anyway, let's get on and do the credits and who's in it, what's in it, well, how's it work, that kind of thing. As I said, it was directed by Richard Quine, a director who directed another movie that I've talked about in Paleo Cinema Podcast, which is one of those kind of movies that isn't very good, but I like it a lot, Paris When It Sizzles, with William Holden and Audrey Hepburn in it. I like that movie a lot for a lot of different reasons. Really kind of, you know, groove on it a fair bit. But he started out as an actor and he went on to direct a number of movies. He directed The World of Susie Wong, for instance, Paris with a Sizzles, Sex and the Single Girl, How to Murder Your Wife, Oh Dad, Poor Dad, Mama's Hung You in the Closet and I'm Feeling So Sad, which is a really dumb title. And one of my kind of favourite of the non-action Rod Taylor movies, 1967's Hotel, which I know Vince Rotolo likes as well. So kind of cool. He went on to do a bit of TV later on and did some directorial work on the shittiest Peter Sellers movie ever, his last movie, The Fiendish Plot of Dr. Fu Manchu. So, Richard Quine got a lot of chops. James Stewart, everyone knows James Stewart. My favourite James Stewart role isn't one of his big ones. It's Cheyenne Social Club. I like him playing an old cowpoke in a comedy where his kind of laconic persona suits the comedy better than it does in Bell, Book and Candle. And Kim Novak, of course, she was in Picnic with William Holden and went on. She reappeared recently. They did a digital makeover of Bell, Book and Candle and she was there for the release of that digital makeover of the film. And she's still looking pretty good and she seemed quite non-star-like and kind of centered and humble about her career, which I kind of like. She's an attractive woman, but she always seemed a bit of a shy and diffident actress, which is interesting. She is much better for the role in this film than he is, for that very reason. The supporting cast is really good. Jack Lemmon's pretty good in it. This is a year before he did Some Like It Hot, and his career really kind of skyrocketed. It started out with Mr. Roberts, but then this is on that kind of upward arc of his career. Ernie Kovacs, the TV genius, who unfortunately died very early in a car accident. He's funny. And the interesting thing, I was watching Ernie Kovacs in this film where he plays a kind of drunken author of non-fiction about the supernatural. And the interesting thing about Ernie Kovacs is he plays drunk in an interesting way. A lot of actors, even comedians, play drunk with slurred speech. Ernie Kovacs doesn't play drunk with a slurred speech. Ernie Kovacs plays drunk with careful speech and his physical actions, his physical acting carries the fact that he's drunk. And it's a little bit different than you get with other people, and I think it works. The kind of hesitant hand gestures, the facial expressions, the way his body moves conveys the fact that he's perpetually drunk really well, but his speech does not, which I really like. I think that's kind of groovy that he, as an actor, made that decision to play it that way. I don't know how much the director had to do with that, but it's an interesting way of playing drunk. The supporting female cast is pretty good too. Janice Rule, who I like a lot in a lot of things, including the one Matt Helm film she did, gets a kind of thankless role as the James Stewart character's fiancée. I probably should do a plot synopsis now. I'm getting into the guts of this. A modern-day witch likes her neighbour, upstairs neighbour, played by James Stewart, but despite his fiancée, so she enchants him to love her instead, only to fall in love with him for real. Which is pretty much it. It's a romantic comedy kind of thing. James Stewart plays Shep Henderson, the publisher. Kim Novak plays Gillian Holroyd, the witch. Jack Lemmon plays her brother, Nicky, the warlock. Ernie Kovacs plays Sidney Redlich, the author. Hermione Gingold, an interesting actress. I got her autobiography, which is How to Grow Old Disgracefully. And, for somebody who wasn't the prettiest of actresses, she had a kind of wild life. And if you can get a hold of her autobiography, it's a very good read. Also, in it, Elsa Lanchester, of course, we know her as the Bride of Frankenstein and as Charles Laughton's wife. They were devoted to each other, but unfortunately, Charles Laughton being gay, theirs was not an entirely happy relationship because of that. And that's pretty much the main cast of the film. And you've seen this before and after this film was made. I mean, of course, before this film, you had I Married a Witch with Frederick March and Veronica Lake in it, which is a little bit of fun. But after this, you had Bewitched and things like that with Elizabeth Montgomery. So the basic trope of the film is kind of commonplace. But I really do like the way it's played in this film up to a certain point. Now, I should play some audio from the film. I've played some of the music, but I'll play some of the audio from the film and just give you an idea about how these characters play against each other in Bell, Book and Candle. This clip's from a nightclub scene in a club called the Zodiac Club between Merle Kittredge, played by Janice Rule, James Stewart's character, Shep, Elsa Lanchester's character, Queenie, and Gillian Holroyd, played by Kim Novak. They're kind of meeting sort of for the first time in a nightclub.
I'm sure you don't mind.
Of course not. We're delighted.
Oh, that's very kind of. There we are. Hi.
I believe Miss Kittredge and I know each other.
Oh? I don't seem to remember.
Wellesley. We were in the same dormitory.
Yes. Yes, of course. You were that girl who used to come to class barefoot. They put you on probation for it, didn't they?
Somebody wrote a note to the dean about it. I wear them in public now, Mr. Henderson.
But,
band, certainly it's different.
Yes, Nicky and the boys play very well together. Nicky's the one playing the bongos. You know, up to a few months ago, he'd never studied music.
Ah, it's quite remarkable.
Yes, particularly when you consider that before that, he used to work in an herb shop.
Looks to me as if he's eaten one herb too many. That's why he acts so creepy, I suppose.
No, it's not that at all. It's just that all the horrors are a little sinister. You see, Nicky's my brother.
Yeah. I'm terribly sorry.
Miss Kittredge had a quirk at college, too. Thunderstorms.
Thunderstorms?
You do remember them.
Just an old bugaboo of mine.
Why, that last spring at school, it was most astonishing. How many dreadful thunderstorms there were, remember?
Yes, I remember.
It was most extraordinary. Why, they lasted for weeks.
Well, they really scare you?
I'd rather not talk about it.
And, of course, that's the band kind of phasing into stormy weather as they're talking about the Merle's phobia of thunderstorms. Anyway, the film kind of is a lot of fun. There's a lot of little bits of magic in it. You've got Elsa Lanchester playing the dotty aunt, and she's a great source of energy for this film. Ernie Kovacs, he's good in the film. I don't think the role was specifically written for him. And doesn't play to his strengths, but he's good fun. He's a great comic relief. Plays well with Jack Lemmon. They've got a few scenes together where they do a little bit of kind of physical comedy, some of which doesn't have any dialogue. And it's all a bit of fun there. But here's where I kind of differ from the film and where I disagree with the film. The problem I've got is the film's set up so that witches can't blush and they can't cry. And if they fall in love, they lose their powers. The problem I've got with it here is that the Gillian Holroyd character lets that happen. She loses everything about herself that's extraordinary and excels in order to fall in love with the James Stewart character. That's the problem I've got with it. And kind of any female power in the film is destroyed by the woman falling in love. And the guy can't handle the fact that she's got these powers. He's kind of antagonistic towards her. Of course, she did make him fall in love with her by casting a spell on him. And he's got that kind of disbelief of the supernatural arc to overcome in the film. But it kind of disappointed me because I found the Gillian character a lot less interesting when she stopped selling primitive artifacts in her shop and started selling seashells. As she lost her powers and became immortal and a human being and that kind of thing. It was an interesting that the female character had to become kind of less interesting and less kind of wild. When she was a witch, she wore kind of black clothing. She went out to exotic nightclubs. Even though she kind of felt that there was a gap in her life, she was living life on her own terms. And by the end of the film, she's living it in the kind of square, middle-class 1950s female roles terms. And I find that a bit of a problem too. Maybe because I'm looking at it from, 50 years onwards, more than 50 years onwards, and times have changed. But I found that disappointing. I only saw the film for the first time a few years ago. So given that, I really found that part disappointing. I found the witch is much more interesting than the mortals or the normal human beings in that sense. And there's bits of dialogue which kind of are interesting to kind of see if there's a subtext to the witch thing. Nicky's never seen with a woman, for instance. The auntie is what we used to call an old maid. And they're a subculture of people alienated from the mainstream. Now, that could be coded any number of ways in 1950s America. But, you can say that it's a kind of coded reference to homosexuality, or it's a coded reference to communism or alternate lifestyles in general, a whole bunch of different things there. And, yes, I am reading too much into that. But I found it really interesting that to be fulfilled in this film, somebody has to lose their uniqueness. Now, that isn't to say I don't like the film. I do. And I think it's that failing is a failing that I Married a Witch, for instance, doesn't have. But it's definitely a failing that a TV series like Bewitched has, where Samantha has to kind of suppress her natural talents to keep her husband happy. Doesn't always work because the family comes in and they maybe are a little bit wiser than her. And even though they're not in the kind of realm of the TV series, it's not suggested that they are. But I kind of like that extraordinariness of the supernatural characters in this film right up until the point where, because of the story arc and the tropes of the times, they have to lose that to kind of find happiness. And the other side of it, I mean, there is a kind of little coda where there's the clinch between the hero and the heroine, and the Auntie Queenie and Nikki, her brother, are watching from outside the window of the shop, and he goes around and kind of zaps out streetlights. He's learned how to zap out streetlights well 50 years before Dumbledore ever did. And kind of, you know, they're living their lifestyle on their own terms, but she's had to give up who she is to a certain extent to find happiness, which is really, well, it sucks to me. So let me know what you think about that, because I found that the one real failing of this film, apart from the miscasting of the protagonist. And the other thing, too, is that James Stewart, this was his last romantic lead. After that, he played fatherly figures and uncles or kind of independent men, but he was never the romantic lead in a movie ever again. There is some talk around the web that Cary Grant was very interested in doing this role. And I think he would have been a much better choice. He would have kind of brought that innate craziness that he had in certain comedies that he did, and that kind of, he could do those double takes and those kind of silly bits, drinking magic potions to get rid of a spell, that kind of stuff. He would have done that really well, and I think a great degree better than James Stewart did. But anyway, that's Spellbook and Candle. I've got a fondness of the film right up to a certain point, and I kind of like the set design. I like the way that magic's portrayed in it. I like the fact that they have bongo drums in it and a cool nightclub where French cabaret actors can sing songs about assassins and, you know, that kind of groovy stuff, really, I do like, but it disappoints me right at the end of the film. Anyway, time to take another break, and then I'm going to get into the feedback, and there is some.
Do we know how to bust Monte Carlo and to never be blue? It's a lot like praying, just keep a saying, yabba dabba 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 doo. If you think your sweetie's left for Tahiti, we can give you a clue. There's no need for crying, roar like a lion, yabba dabba 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 doo. B-A-D-D-A means bad, D-A-B-B-A means good. Oh, what magic in a word we've found by switching the letters around. So if someday the bases are loaded and they're counting on you, you just can't strike out if you'll up and shout, yabba dabba dabba, yabba dabba dabba, yabba dabba 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 doo.
B-A-D-D-A means bad, D-A-B-B-A means good. Oh, what magic in a word we found by switching the letters around.
Someday the bases are loaded and they're counting on you. You just can't strike out if you'll up and shout, yabba dabba dabba, yabba dabba dabba, yabba dabba 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 doo, yabba dabba 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 doo.
I tell you, cartoons were never hipper than that. That was Hoagy Carmichael from the Flintstones singing Yabba Dabba 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 Doo. Hoagy Carmichael, I always remember for a couple of things, one of which is the fact that he was one of the physical models for James Bond. There's a scene in one of the James Bond novels where somebody mentions the fact that he looks like a young Hoagy Carmichael. So, you know, very hip guy, very cool song from, you know, like a kid's cartoon. So, you know, incredibly hip stuff. Anyway, on to the feedback. Let's get on with the first one, and I'll bring it up now. The first one's from Morris Brzezinski, and he says, happy belated birthday. Hope you had a cinematically fulfilling time. I've enjoyed the last couple of shows, and I've secured Odd Man Out to watch, so I'm looking forward to that. I finally got around to watching a film I meant to see for many years, the original Ernst Lubitsch version of To Be or Not to Be. I can certainly see why folks prefer it over the Mel Brooks version, and yet I still feel that the remake has been unfairly maligned. Stole many of its best lines from the original. I guess the original was all the more interesting considering it was made during the war, from the eye of the hurricane, as it were. It's hard to make a film tackling such a difficult subject into something genuinely funny and still have great melancholy and never get mawkish, in my opinion. It's been years since I last saw the Great Dictator, a film I also like, but I think this is better. Is this a film you've discussed in Paleo Cinema? No, it isn't, unfortunately, but it is something that I do have to have a look at. There's so many films and so little time. If I was a full-time movie watcher, I'd be more than happy to do it, but I'll put it on the list. I've got a list of things I'm going to take a look at. And, yeah, and he also goes on to say, I hope you're well. Look forward to you tracking your alphabetical progress. By the way, I've started a blog, Who Hasn't, on albums I love at, and if you want to go to the link, it's Love That Album, one word, lowercase, .blogspot.com. Have a look if you have the time. Be well. Cheers, Morris. Thanks for that. Yeah, I'm definitely going to look at that site. Always up for a new website. And I will also post a link in the link field on the paleocinema.blogspot.com website for you as well. So thanks for that. Yeah, To Be or Not to Be, I've seen the Mel Brooks version with the Hitler rap and all that sort of thing. Haven't seen The Great Dictator yet. I'm really down on my chapel. I only got to see Limelight for the first time because I was going to talk about it on the radio with Ivor. But, yeah, I've really got to kind of get into my sound-era Chaplin a little more than I have in the past. Again, it's one of those things, there's so much out there. It's a little bit hard at times to stay on top of everything. There's just too much of the damn stuff. I did get an email from our friend Rupert, who told me that Sands of the Kalahari, a really cool action film that I love, is going to be out on Blu-ray this year. Olive Films have announced that they're going to be releasing it on Blu-ray, so check out your Amazon.com and other places that you buy your Blu-rays from. It's coming out on DVD as well, which is how I'll probably end up picking it up, for the simple reason that I have problems with international zoning on a lot of Blu-rays, and I don't want to kind of take the risk if I don't have to. But glad that Sands of the Kalahari is out. It's an incredibly underrated action film, as I said at the time that I reviewed it. And thanks for that, Rupert. By the way, if you go over to the GGTMC podcast, Rupert's got a couple of really great interviews he's done recently there as well. I've really got to send those guys a comment. And I think that, to be honest with you, mate, your interviewing skills, they were good at the start and they're improving now. And I really do kind of enjoy watching you get better at what you enjoy doing. And really did like that. He's got one with a guy who works for Scarecrow Video in Seattle, a place I've actually visited, and also from somebody representing the Alamo Drafthouse in Austin, Texas. So great stuff. And they just sit there and shoot the shit about cult films. And it's a lovely addition to what Sammy and Big William do at GGTMC, and really well worth your time listening to it. So thanks very much for that, Rupert. And the heads up to everybody that Sands of the Kalahari is coming out. Okay, I also got a message left on the blog from someone called Aria, who said, did you ever find a term for those movies that you'd like to watch just because they're fun? I have books that I reread for similar reasons. I call them comfort books. I'm not sure if comfort films is quite what you're after, but oh well. Yeah, I don't know either.
for, we've got to find a term for those movies that they kind of, you wrap around you like a blanket. For me, the Jacques Tati films are very much like that, and I really am reluctant to watch them too often because I don't want the magic to go away. But we've got to, if anybody's got a term for those films, that they're not guilty pleasures or anything like that, but they're warms that, the movies that make you feel warm and fuzzy and kind of, yeah, restore your faith in humanity in a sense, I suppose. But yeah, there's got to be a term for that. We've got to come up with something, people. The sooner the better. Okay, let's move on to the next one. And I believe it is, he said, faking it, I believe it is our old friend, Dr. Zom.
Terry Frost of Paleo Cinema. This is Dr. Zom. Oh, I just had an exquisite morning. Something that's cheered me up from the moment that I heard the first breath spoken on ABC Darwin, ABC Radio. And that was the Frost Giant, Terry Frost, covering the Duke, John Wayne, Angie Dickinson, Ricky Nelson in Rio Bravo. Rio Bravo. An excellent movie because it has a lot of R's in the title. Great job. I really enjoyed it. Loved the banter. Loved the some of the talk about the Old West, the dime novels, the penny novels, probably penny novels back then, I don't know. Very good, very good. And you just caught me with that while I was watching a movie that, as an impressionable and not very knowledgeable about the real world kid, one of my favorite movies also starred the Duke, John Wayne, and that was The Green Berets. Now, everybody calm down. We all know that, you know, The Green Berets was kind of a right-wing kind of a movie. It was kind of pro-military, pro-Vietnam, you know, what we were doing in Vietnam. Everybody calm down. You know, I know it's not The Deer Hunter. It's not Apocalypse Now. It's not Coming Home. But, you know, I enjoyed this movie. And I think for historical significance, it's an important movie, too, because it was almost like at the junction point of old Hollywood and old Hollywood war movies, right after this, or actually during this time, 1968, was when things were changing. You weren't going to get, Sergeant Stryker, Sands of Iwo Jima. You weren't going to get a lot of these, you know, the Battle of the Bulge and movies that we were used to that showed, you know, the we're the good guys against the bad guys and you know, the heroics and all this and that. You started getting the movies that showed the horror of war, the dark side of war, the guys coming back broken and messed up with post-traumatic stress or disabled and things like that. And there's a lot of good movies, you know, out there that covered all that. But like I said, this is the junction point. This is old Hollywood's last hoorah in that kind of field. Great cast. I'm not going to ramble on too much because I tend to get going and then take up a lot of time. But of course, you had John Wayne, you had David Janssen, a really favorite of mine that died way too soon. His legacy lives on through his son, but was Jim Hutton. What a likable guy. What a likable, most of the movies that I ever saw him in, he just seemed like a really cool dude. Aldo Ray was also in this movie, and I remember him being one of my favorites from this movie. Raymond St. Jacques, who played Doc McGee, also, a cool actor that not many people probably remember, but he was in The Pawnbroker, Cotton Comes to Harlem. He was in a lot of really cool stuff. Let me see here also, because I'm like a lot of other people who are leaving feedback and podcasting and stuff like that that rely on the IMDb. But anyway, you had Jack Sue from Barney Miller, George Takei, who played Mr. Sulu on Star Trek, Luke Askew, and that's one thing, and Mike Henry, who also was a football player that also played Tarzan at one time. Really cool and eclectic cast. The one thing that kind of brought up for me was, you know, John Wayne was also known for his right-wing politics, but it never stopped him from working with a vast array of people who weren't like that. I remember Dennis Hopper talking about, you know, him and John Wayne, you know, arguing about politics and him saying, "Where's that Hopper? Where's that Hopper? That hippie?" And, you know, Luke Askew was in this movie, and he was kind of a hippie, too. And then you had, of course, like I said, George Takei, who, you know, had an alternate lifestyle. Same with Rock Hudson in The Undefeated with John Wayne. And I remember hearing a story one time about John Wayne. I guess he was a big card player, and I don't know if they were – him and his wife were playing bridge or something like that with another couple, and someone brought up the rumor at the time that Rock Hudson was, you know, there was a rumor that Rock Hudson was a homosexual. And I guess John Wayne kind of, you know, I don't want to say put his foot down, but he said, you know, whatever a man does, you know, in his own home is his business. And he basically, you know, stopped the rumor spreading or whatever right there, which I thought was pretty cool. Another movie, and then I'm going to get off here, that I watched that was kind of a little bit later on, that kind of tried to go back. It was a Samuel Fuller movie that sort of went back to this type of, you know, what we used to call, what's your favorite war movie? I watched the other day that I picked up on DVD, and that was The Big Red One. Samuel Fuller also had, you know, the starring Lee Marvin, and at the time a rising star known as Mark Hamill, who was Luke Skywalker in the Star Wars movies. It was a kind of a throwback movie, World War II movie, made in, I believe, I don't have it right in front of me, but something like 1980 maybe. And I remember it didn't do very well because it was, you know, kind of seen as a throwback movie like that, and people wanted to see Platoon or something like that. But it's still a good movie. It still holds up. I really liked it. And last thing I'm going to say about The Green Berets, which I forgot to add, is that I picked it up on Blu-ray. And out of probably seeing this movie 100 times since I was, you know, 7 years old, this is the best it's ever looked. You get the full screen, and everything is so clear. It really is a pleasure to watch. And like I said, I know a lot of people probably aren't a fan of this movie, but, you know, I'm looking at it as for entertainment purposes, and I really enjoyed it. And that's all that I have to say. Great job, Teddy. Sorry that you had to kick Sally out of the room for her hacking fit. And I'm going to go right now because I have to go put my mail in the mailbox. Have a great day. Dr. Zom, saying Zom out.
Thanks for that, Zom. I'm glad you finally linked up to me talking live on ABC local radio in Darwin. It's really nice that you did that, mate. It's a groovy thing for me to do. I love talking with Ivor. As you said, the back and forth between him and I works really well. He's just so easy to deal with. And if you want to listen in on that, it's happening on Thursday nights Australian time. Australian Eastern Standard Time, about 9 p.m. I get a phone call from Darwin, and Ivor and I, it's not going to be Ivor for the next couple of weeks because he's on holiday, but we talk about movies for about between 20 minutes and half an hour, just grooving on one particular film. Next time around, I'm actually doing it with a lady called Anne Marie, and we're going to talk about The Red Shoes, which I'm finding a bit daunting because I haven't watched The Red Shoes yet, haven't seen it yet. I've got the Blu-ray, which I picked up for about $9, which is a bonus, fantastic Blu-ray, $9, Pell and Pressburg, you've got to love that. So I'm doing that, but if you can kind of get your international clock going on your computer or on your iPhone and then go to abc.net.au/Darwin, lowercase, you'll be able to listen in on it. And I'm sure that the ABC people would really like to have people streaming and listening from all around the world. That's one of the reasons why they do that. And yeah, it's great. Green Berets, haven't seen it for a very long time. Going to have to catch up with it. The supporting cast, yeah, Jim Hutton, great actor. Of course, his son, Timothy Hutton. Jack Su, I like Jack Su. I liked him from Barney Miller, but I like Jack Su most because he had a singing role in Flower Drum Song, where he sang a song called Don't Marry Me, which was quite funny. He was in the original stage production of that, Robert Jones and the Hammerstein musical, but Jack Su's really groovy in there as well. And yeah, John Wayne was kind of tolerant of other people's lifestyles to a great extent. He worked in cinema for a very long time, and yeah, his politics were incredibly right-wing, but I think that, and people like Ed Asner had some trouble with him as well. They said that he was a bit anti-Semitic and things like that. But in general, if he was somewhere on the side of tolerance, then we've got to give the guy a bit of credit, particularly given when and where he came from. So there is that. Thanks for that, Zom. Always welcome, mate. And look after yourself and the two dogs as well. I'm sure they're getting to be a bit of a handful now. The weather's getting nicer around there. So anyway, that's about it for this time around. I am going to go off now and watch me some Filipino exploitation movies because I'm on kind of roll with that stuff at the moment. And then after that, I'm going to kind of get into the Red Shoes and bite off more than I can chew again. It's like the Australian radio star of the 1950s, Jack Stavey, said, bite off more than you can chew and chew like buggery. Anyway, that's about it. Enjoy your movie watching. Thanks for listening. And I will be back in a fortnight with the Sea movies.